welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Linda Lloyd, and it's my pleasure to welcome USA Today bestselling author Donna Everhart. Her latest book, The Road to Bittersweet, is published by Kensington Books. I know it's been almost exactly a year since we talked, and at that time we were talking about Dixie Dupree, who was an 11-year-old in Alabama. Now I'd like to talk with you about Wallace Ann Stamper, who's a similar sort of personality, but is growing up in 1940s North Carolina. Wallace Ann is part of a very talented family. Tell me a little bit about the family and how she fits. What's her role in there?
Sure. First, I'd like to say thank you for having me back. I like being here, and I appreciate the opportunity. Wallace Ann is the middle child. As you said, she's 14. And, of course, we've got the rest of her family consisting of Papa Stamper, who works at Evergreen Sawmill, a very industrious man, a hard worker. We have Mama Stamper, who's very loving towards the children, a very proud woman. And we have Lacey, who is the older sister of Wallace Ann. She's 16. And she is a unique character in that when she was born, the cord was around her neck and or tied in a true knot, as they say. And so she had suffered a little bit of lack of oxygen. So back in the day, they would have called her an idiot savant. And in today's terms, she would be an autistic savant. And so she is talented with music, but she does not speak. She's mute. And then there's little Seth, who's only 3 years old. And, of course, he's the apple of everybody's eye.
Because he's the only boy, of course.
That's right.
Wallace Ann's name is very unique. It's not Wallace, W-A-L-L-A-C-E, like we would think of as a man's name. It's W-A-L-L-I-S. How was she given that name?
Wallace Ann's name came actually from her mother's. So it's a family name on her mother's side, and it's the complete reversal of her mother's name. Her mother was Ann Wallace, and then when she married Papa, of course, she became Ann Wallace Stamper. And when Wallace Ann was born, the granny woman who was delivering her had said, "What's this one's name going to be?" And Mama had said, "Wallace Ann." And the granny woman was sort of taken back because it was such a masculine-sounding name. And she actually said, "Well, you mean Wallace like a boy?" And Mama had responded, "Girl needs a strong name in these parts." So she really just took a reversal of her name and just flipped it around. But she chose that name because of the strength behind it. It does have a masculine sound to it.
And then Lacey sounds feminine.
Right.
And Wallace Ann thinks that name fits her sister very well because she seems more delicate, more fragile. Is that because she doesn't speak? Or is it just, you know, because Wallace Ann does the work of a man. She's really tough.
Yeah, she does. It is kind of interesting because, and of course, this was sort of purposeful while I was writing the story. I wanted to offset those two sisters. And Wallace Ann is very sturdy, and like you said, she works like a man. And she sees herself that way, too, just this strong, sturdy girl. Whereas Lacey is absolutely beautiful, a very delicate type of beauty, very tall and slender. And, of course, Wallace Ann compares her to the willow trees that are planted beside Stamper's Creek. And It's suiting, you know, to her for that. And so the names are very, to me, representative of their personalities and their just the way they are.
Well, I referred to the fact that Wallace Ann reminded me of Dixie, but only in the way that they were stubborn and some of the, you know, the ways that they would react to things, I guess. Did you find them to be similar characters?
Well, I do like to write these young girls, these protagonists that are, like you said, strong, stubborn type of individuals. And I actually don't know why that is, except maybe I'm a little bit like that too. You know, so you kind of tend to write what you know. But I do like the idea that they are going to come up against what we could potentially view as insurmountable odds and come out on the other side of it. And so for me, anyway, when I was writing these two characters, I had that in mind. I knew I needed something entirely different from Dixie Dupree. Yet at the same time, I was looking for somebody that had that strength of conviction. And that's what I was trying to put into Wallace Ann.
Well, Wallace Ann definitely has that. She is sort of her sister's protector. That's one of her roles, it seems like.
Yes.
The night that they go to bed and Mama's already kind of set the stage, there's a big storm coming and Papa tells her to be ready.
Right.
She still has to get her sister ready as well. The only thing that Lacey wants won't even budge without her fiddle.
Right.
Why is that? Why is that possession so important?
For her, it's her way of communicating. She has no other way at this point in time of communicating. And for her to be without the fiddle would be like not having a limb. And I did some research on autistic savants, and they tend to, or again, everybody's probably very unique and individual when it comes to this kind of a thing, but they can latch on to something and it becomes, you almost want to say, like an obsession with them. And without it, you know, their security is gone. And for her, not only would it have been a security for her, but I think it's her way of communicating in that moment. So she had to have it.
Well, I knew that the grandfathers had gotten lost in an earlier flood, and so Wallace Ann was concerned about that, but mm-hmm. I hadn't thought about it being Lacey's way of communicating.
Yeah.
Lacey also had what the family called the piano incident,
yes.
which I thought was fun. Talk a little bit about the piano incident.
The piano incident is where they discovered that Lacey had this talent. They didn't know before this. And it would have been at a time when the book opens up, Wallace Ann is just turning 14 and Lacey is 16. And at this time, Wallace Ann would have been maybe around 4 and Lacey would have been around 6. And they go to church. They're church-going people. And for the first time, though, they're having this church picnic. And the Stampers are a musical family overall. They all sing. And at that time, it was just Mama and Papa doing the singing. And so they would go around to these church events, the fish fries and things like that, fall festivals. But anyway, they're at the church, and the girls are sitting on the pew like they always are. And then they go out after they've done the performance. They go out onto the lawn. All of them are supposed to be out there filling up their plates with the food. And Wallace Ann notices that Lacey is nowhere to be found. And all of the parents are preoccupied, and all of a sudden she hears piano music. And she can't quite figure out where this is coming from, so she goes running back inside, and there sits Lacey. And she was too small at the time to pull that heavy wooden piano bench forward, but she's standing there at the piano, and she's playing the last song that the lady had played. And that was the thing that Wallace Ann had noticed, was while she was sitting there beside Lacey before they discover Lacey playing, she had felt Lacey's breath quicken and knew that there was something about the piano that had excited her. And anyway, she discovers her there playing that last song, "The Saints Go Marching In," and then the parents come rushing in, and that's when they discovered that she had this gift. And so they always referred to it from that point on as the piano incident.
But the piano is not she can play pretty much anything that she sees played once.
Yes.
Not necessarily by ear, but almost by seeing
yes.
someone else play it.
Yes.
That's what I thought.
And she watches their hands, and it's the fiddle that actually becomes her, I want to say, like, go-to instrument. It's the one that's the most portable. You can't drag a piano around. But she could also play the mountain dulcimer. But I, for the sake of the story, I had focused on the fiddle.
Well, and it seemed logical to me that that would be the one, especially knowing that her grandfathers had played the fiddle earlier, and that's the one thing that they
right.
lost in the flood from before.
Right.
But when the flood comes, the family decides to leave. They don't really know where they're going. They know that they have to escape. All of them are in the pickup truck, but then they end up in the back of the pickup truck.
Yeah.
Papa and Seth, the little boy, are washed over the side, and it's just the three females left, and then they're washed over.
Right.
The Wallace Ann is able to grab onto something and eventually climb a tree, but she's all alone.
Yes.
How does she survive? I mean, what is the mental thought process that a 14-year-old would have? I'm in a tree. I have no help. And she's seeing animals that are dead float by. She sees a body float by. I mean, what would you do when you're 14?
I think it's the youth. It's partly because of youth and the desire to live. I mean, she's young, you know. And I also think that because she's so strong, she's got that going for her. And she also has Coy Skinner riding her shoulders, which is the ghost. She considers it like the ghost of Coy Skinner. This is a story that her mother has told her about an earlier flood that she had experienced, the one you're referring with the grandfather, which was her mother's father. And he was washed away in the 1916 flood. And this is now the 1940 flood, but she's heard the story of Coy Skinner. So I think it's kind of a combination. It's her youth and the desire to live. And at that age, you know, you're almost, even today, of course, we know how kids feel like they're invincible. But I still think even back then, for a young person to have been raised in that time frame, they're very self-sufficient. They know the things to do, you know, sort of a survivalist kind of skill set that they have. And again, being young and just sort of having that mental attitude of it's not over yet for me. And I think all of those things combined together really helped her to sort of look at the situation and figure out for herself how she was going to save herself. And she had that desire to do so.
She runs into a couple of different people on her way back to make her way back because she's not really sure where she is at first. She has to kind of figure out from landmarks where she actually is and try to make her way back to the farm. She runs into a guy who's kind of giving her a hard time, Leland Tews.
Yes.
And he comes back up in the story. I told my husband he reminds me of Ernest T. Bass on the Andy of Mayberry show.
Yeah.
That's exactly who I was picturing. I had, you know, pictures of all of these people. How did you come up with such a colorful character?
I have fun when I do this kind of thing. I really do, especially when I'm getting into some of these characters who are questionable, you know, like Leland too. You know, it's probably just kind of a combination maybe of maybe somebody like an Ernest T. Bass, because I know exactly who you're talking about. It may also be a little bit of influence of seeing movies, you know, and seeing some of these characters. I mean, you just got to get it in your head. Okay, who would be the kind of character that would really creep me out if I were to run up against somebody that's going to be, you know,
a little creepy?
Yeah. That you just, can I trust them? You know, there's just something off. I was trying to portray somebody that was off, a little bit unstable, unbalanced. So, yes, Leland, too, was definitely a fun character to write with his wandering eye and his way of just communicating with all of the innuendos that turned out to be nothing but a bunch of hot air, really.
Yeah, but Wallace Ann handled him well, and then at the same time, Joe Calhoun comes along.
Yes.
He's from a neighboring farm. She doesn't really know him, but it's almost like they have an immediate connection. Is that because they're both survivors? They've both lost so much?
You know, Joe Calhoun, and again, it's kind of from a personal perspective that I write these characters. And so I'm looking at, and I'll be honest here, you know, I don't want to give away any spoilers for people who haven't read the book. But I'm always trying to look ahead. How is this character going to fit into the future of another character that they've encountered? So I had that in mind. And I wanted Joe Calhoun to be very similar to Wallace Ann in personality from the, just like what you're saying, you know, from a survivorship kind of viewpoint of the world. You know, I've survived a lot of things. I've been through a lot of things. The strength that the person has, the fortitude that they have. And so those were, to me, similar characteristics to give them. And so I think that they connected. You know, there's a little bit of something that's mentioned too a little later on in the book that Wallace Ann recognizes about Joe. Well, he could work like I do. He works like I do. So, yes, you know, I think that's exactly it, that there's those similarities. You know how it is when you meet somebody that you click with.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes you may not want to accept it at first, you know, because you're thinking, oh, no, that's not the path intended for me. But at the same time, you just kind of know, okay, I really connected with that person, be it male or female, you know, best friends and things like that.
Well, Joe does help her once Seth gets sick, try to get to the doctor.
Yes.
So that they can help Seth because he's very, very ill. When she brings him back to the farm, her father's reaction is like, you know, and at first you're not really sure why he's reacting so strongly. Is it because of the age? You know, he's an older man. You know, he obviously has a relationship. Why did Papa hate him so much?
He knew of Joe Calhoun's father, Whiskey Joe Calhoun. And he did not care for him at all. You know, this very small, remote area. I mean, their cabin literally would have been in the middle of nowhere. But, you know, they go to the town, you know, a couple of the towns and get what they need every now and then. And there would be talk about how Whiskey Joe Calhoun had killed a man over a card game. Things like that. So in his mind, there's no good Calhoun. And so he just didn't like him based on his family.
Well, I thought it was very observant of Wallace Ann that after, you know, they go through the flood, they're all back together again, things are not good, and they're all very hungry. Something happens, and she says something got broke in the family.
Yeah.
And so that next straw was, we got to go.
Right.
Then they get to Papa's brother. And he's a lot like Joe Calhoun's father.
Yes.
That's what I was thinking, is these two characters, maybe that's part of the reason Papa doesn't like him so much.
Yes, you know, that's actually a good point. And in writing the book, I actually never thought about that. But again, a reader has got their own interpretation of how these relationships are the way they are or why they are the way they are. And Uncle Hardy... It was kind of funny because, you know, Mama Stamper is saying, you know, you can't spend more than X amount of time with your brother. You know, they just rub each other the wrong way. Part of why Papa Stamper doesn't get along with his brother is because he's so stingy. Yet he's thinking he won't turn family away. Well, he didn't turn family away, but yet he lorded his ability to control the situation over them, how much food they could eat. It was almost like they were starting to beg already before they had actually started to beg. And that is really kind of what was in the forefront of my mind as I was writing this character, this particular character, is that he was going to be a real piece of work. You know, he just wanted to have control and to dole out. And that was his only way of having control, was to be able to, with them in particular, to manage the food supply.
Well, it was interesting. Even Wallace Ann noticed that the dog was very well fed.
Yes.
And she's thinking, okay, he's feeding the dog well, but he's making us portion out one potato for all five of us.
Yeah.
You know, that personality type. Plus it sounded like he had moonshine jugs all over the yard. Is that what that was?
Yes. Yes.
She didn't ever say that out loud, but that was what I kind of got.
Yeah.
Dark brown at the top and beige at the bottom.
Yeah.
Okay. That's kind of what
that
I was thinking,
it.
But
yep.
I wasn't really
he's
sure.
Doing a little drinking too. Yeah.
So finally, they get fed up, and they do start on the road, and they have to start begging.
Right.
Her mother is not comfortable with this at all.
No.
And the first time that they stop at a store, she is very embarrassed. Why was she so set against them? Well, she didn't even want to ask Hardy for charity. Why was she so against asking for something? Because at this point, they have nothing.
Right. I would just say it's her pride. She just was insistent that they could do something different. There's got to be another way around this. There's got to be some other way. And Wallace Ann was a little bit like this too. She certainly, you know, when Papa had said, we're going to sing, sort of like sing for their supper kind of thing. Her first response is, "You mean like beggars?" And did not like that at all. So there was a little bit of that similarity between her and her mother. The pride from her mother. She had all of these things. Yes, they had this cabin, but there was the part where she has this beautiful stove. Instead of the old coal-burning kind of stove, she has this Glenwood Sea stove, which had that kind of painted enamel kind of outside, you know. She was thinking about painting the walls so that they wouldn't be tacked with newspaper. Yet Mama was the one who had said anything, especially when it comes to cultivating what you grow outside, was there because of God, and they were just there to nurture it. And at the same time, though, she had a little bit of that weakness in her for the finer things, like that stove, and to have the painted walls inside of her cabin. And so I would look at it as she can't, you know, probably a pillar in the community from the church-going perspective as a female. And here we are on the side of the road, just digging for potatoes and begging. And, you know, both her and Wallace Ann were, like I said, similar in their thought processes for that.
I felt so sorry for them.
I did.
I mean,
too. Yeah.
And I can just picture.
And I did too.
Yeah, it's like you just want to cry for this family. They have absolutely nothing. They talk about being thirsty. I mean, they can't find water sometimes. When they do find it, it has to be boiled and then cooled. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a family who deserves to beg if they need to.
Right. Yeah.
But they find, you know, they get chased off by different people. They're run out of different places.
Yeah.
They finally found a place that they could set up camp. And just by serendipity, Wallace Ann hears a waterfall and sees a man jump off of it.
Yes.
And that's how they meet
Clayton.
Clayton. And
yeah.
Clayton is very instrumental in their future.
Yes, he is. So they have found this spot, like you say, that they're not being run off from. And Wallace Ann always wants to go back there, number one, because there's fresh water accessible to them. And also because she does end up having this, I love the word, serendipitous moment, you know, with Clayton, where she's walking and she's just wanting to be alone for a little bit. And it actually shocks her when she first sees him take that plunge. She's thinking, is he trying to kill himself? What is he doing? And, of course, she discovers that he is actually practicing for his high dive act with the Johnny Cooper traveling show. And so they develop this friendship. And like you say, he was very helpful with their future. And hopefully, you know, trying to make things turn around for them.
He did not realize how bad it was.
No.
And he says, "Why didn't you tell me?" And she said, "We're proud."
Right.
Is that typical, or would it be typical of people from the mountain during that time?
Absolutely.
And that's still exactly how I saw it.
Absolutely. And still is today. They're very proud. They don't want anything from anybody.
We don't talk about our troubles.
Right. Exactly.
What happens in this house stays in this house.
Self-sufficient. We can do. Yes. We can do for ourselves. We can take care of ourselves, and we take care of our own kind of thing. And he did not know. And I actually, you know, in certain parts of a book, as you're writing, at least for me, it's almost like the book writes itself. And I was there was an area where they had met several times. You know, she was always wanting to go back, you know, and be by herself without Lacey kind of clinging to her, which is how she's starting to feel like because of their circumstances. Lacey, being the way she is, has had her routines broken up, and she no longer has that routine. And so she's just really wanting a little bit of a reprieve and time on her own away from Lacey's clinging hand. And so she's going into the woods, and she's going to this waterfall, and she's meeting with Clayton, and she's got this new friend. And, of course, just like any young people, you know how they are, it's very innocent. There's, you know, nothing going on. They're just friends. And they get into this little sort of ragtag kind of game of tag, and she gets weak, and she has to stop and bend over. And that's when he says, "Are you okay? Do you need to sit down?" And she's thinking about how she hasn't had much to eat, and that's why she's so lightheaded. And he does not know, you know, he did not know that it was that bad. And of course, he, at some point, I don't know if I'm kind of getting ahead of myself here, but he brings them. Lacey does eventually come and is with Wallace Ann and gets to meet Clayton, and he brings them spun sugar, which they have never had from the fair. And, of course, to them, it's extra special. You know, it's sort of like the real food, first real food they've had in a while. So,
and I can't imagine being that hungry. I mean, I've never been hungry.
Yeah.
I don't think we can picture that. I really don't.
Right.
What it feels like to actually be hungry and to be 14 and be powerless, basically, to do anything about it. Do you think Papa could have done something differently?
I've had a lot of people ask that question. I feel like he was trying to do what he knew there was nothing on the mountain. He knew the weather was going to change. They had no food. They had tried to pack up all that food as they were making the escape, and of course it gets all washed out in the river, so they have nothing. Then they go back, the house is gone, the garden is gone, you know, a couple rotted melons is all that was left. They dug for potatoes, found a few, but, you know, you're staying there or thinking you're going to stay there. And so he had done that stint, knowing that there was nothing left, didn't have any tools to rebuild, didn't have any gun to shoot or, you know. And so they leave, and then there's the Uncle Hardy period. You know, that didn't work out so well. It felt like he was begging there. And so for him, he's doing everything that he can. The sawmill's not going to open up anytime soon where he can make money. So that job is gone for now. And he's just looking at it like, well, we've got this God-given talent. Why not just use this talent that we have to make a few coins, enough to be able to just maybe buy some flour and some sugar and some cornmeal and some beans. You know, I'm thinking that this is where he's headed. But, of course, everybody's been involved in the flood. And so there's very few people that have anything. There's probably very few parts of that area at that time where people could afford to help in the way that they would have helped before.
Right.
And it's so remote. You know, it's like the random occasion that they meet up with somebody. So it was difficult, and he was doing, I feel like, anything, you know.
That when he could.
Yeah, anything and everything that he could.
Which is why he lets them join, basically, the traveling show with Clayton and Mr. Jones. Do you think Mr. Jones looked at it as, oh, here's somebody else I can exploit? Because he obviously had, you know, the fat lady and things that we would not see today.
Right, exactly. So this was, again, too, another part of the book where I was writing it that I was having a lot of fun with, because even though the circumstances were dire, I had to give them a reprieve. And when it comes to Johnny Cooper, he was a person that was out looking out for how to make a dime. And, of course, the discovery that they make with Lacey kind of was exactly the thing that he would have been looking to exploit, just like some of the other people that would be part of a traveling show back in that time frame, for sure.
Because they were a draw. I mean, every time that they sang, they brought people in. And
yep.
He probably was at a point where they had seen what he already had to show, and this was a new act.
Right, exactly. When they first started singing, there was that one particular scene where Papa has finally agreed, after Wallace Ann has relayed to them, yes, okay, this is, I've met this boy. And of course, their mama and Papa, because of the time frame, you know, back then, it's like, oh my goodness, you know, what do you mean, kind of thing. And then she explains, it's about a job. It's about a job. I think I have us a job. And so she gives them the quick rundown. And Papa, he's kind of like at his wit's end. You know, it hasn't served well, all of the things that they've done so far. And he's willing to take that risk. And Mama's a little bit hesitant, but she sort of sees, too, well, what else are we going to do? And so there's that one scene where they show up, and I talk about how they spill out of the truck and all of their dirty, rank glory. And, I mean, they've spent weeks with no way in the same clothes that were part of the river run, you know, where they're trying to escape from that. Everything's kind of shredded and almost rotting off of them. You can imagine, you know, hair is greasy, faces are dirty, because boiling water was simply for drinking and survival. You know, can't waste it on really getting clean too much, although they had tried a couple times. But they are looked at originally from the rest of the crowd that's there, the workers that are there at the carnival. They're looked at and probably judged by how they look. Like, are you kidding me? What are they going to do? And then they start to sing. And Lacey has that fiddle. She has her fiddle back because of the store. It's not her fiddle. It's one that was given to her where they had met those friends at that store and were given some things, you know, to help them on their way. And it just, one of the things happened to be a fiddle that one of those older ladies could no longer play because of her arthritis. So Lacey's got this fiddle now, and when she starts to play and the family starts to sing, like you say, they ended up being a draw because they are obviously talented and like the new number one show, and Johnny Cooper's probably got dollar signs ringing up in his eyes.
a new people. What else can we do? Yeah,
exactly.
Well, Wallace Ann makes a decision while they're with the traveling show to tell her parents something that she knows is going to cause a big rift.
Yes.
Why did she do that?
Jealousy. This is without giving away any spoilers, this was a point in the book where it had come to a head with her. She had had this friendship with Clayton, and in her mind, there's this betrayal. And it's her first experience with this sort of thing, you know? And a little bit of it was revenge. You know, this is where you have a little bit of that flawed character coming through, where something is happening that seems a little out of character for how you know that person to be up until a point. And then they react, you know, just like any other person probably would under the similar circumstances. Jealousy is such a strong, strong emotion, and it can make people do things that they wouldn't have done before. And so she decides to let her mother and father know what's going on.
It's almost like it is a normal reaction, I guess, with all that she's experienced. First of all, she's got some guilt about other things that have happened that she felt like she caused or maybe could have prevented. And then Lacey's kind of gone off a couple of times. She's missed her and everything. But why did her parents expect so much more from her than you would think they would of any 14-year-old girl? It was almost like they treated her as an adult.
Right.
And didn't expect her to react as a child.
Right. I think part of this comes from the time frame. It's 1940. And if you think about that time and back then, by the time a child, and actually sometimes even the girls, I'm not going to say a child right now, I'll focus on a girl. When I think about Wallace Ann and how old she is, I can't help, for instance, but think of Loretta Lynn. She was married at 14 and having children by the time she was 15. There were young men back then who were working in mines, for instance, in Loretta Lynn's part of the world, when they were 8 years old, even younger maybe. And it was just different. They were all expected to pull their weight. And I think they matured a lot earlier back then. And I think if a reader today, and the way we are kind of today, children take a lot longer to grow up and mature, it seems like. And, you know, I don't want to kind of put everybody in the same, under the same umbrella. You know, there's probably differences, I'm sure, out there. But for this time frame of what I'm writing about, that's what I think about. It was different. There was a lot more responsibility expected from a very, very young age. Think about, for instance, in maybe families that are growing cotton. You might have a 3 or 4 year old out there dragging a little 10 pound sack, picking cotton. They're working.
Because you had to.
Yes.
It was.
Yes. They were having children a lot of times just to help work around the farm. That was kind of the labor pool was expected to be the family, the children. And so it was just a different era. And they to me, Mama and Papa Stamper were treating Wallace Ann as they would. They knew Lacey was different. You know, she couldn't handle the same things that Wallace Ann could. But Wallace Ann was the backbone of that family in a lot of ways. And I can see why.
Well, I felt like she had a lot of more resilience even than her mother,
yes,
both physically and emotionally, because
yeah,
she always had the positive attitude even when her mother was at the worst.
And this is just differences, too, in personality. You know, Mama, like I was saying earlier, has a little bit of that pride. So you could look at that. It could get away with her, maybe. And then Mama was also dealing with some depression, losing a home, and many other things. And I feel like she had sort of emotionally checked out to some degree and could not handle a lot of what Wallace Ann could, because Wallace Ann, to me, is just more pragmatic. She's more like her father, so you got a mix of Mama and Papa, but Papa was a lot like that. You notice, if you think about it, Papa kept going forward. You know,
true,
let's do this, let's do this. Well, we're going to do this. He was always trying to move it forward, move it forward. He didn't want to stay behind through the winter at the homestead where there was nothing. You know, let's leave. We've got to leave and move forward. And Wallace Ann was a lot like that.
Well, you've written two very strong young ladies. What's next for you?
I am actually very, very excited about my third book. It will be out February of 2019. It's called The Forgiving Kind, and talking about cotton. It's set in 1955 in eastern North Carolina on a cotton farm. And it deals with, yet again, another strong young female lead. Her name is actually, her formal name is Martha Simpson Creech, but she's known as Sunny Creech. And she's 12 years old. And she has a best friend named Daniel Lassiter, who is 12 years old. And if I were going to give you just a quick, like one or two sentences of what this book is about, after a tragedy, you know me, I've got to write about, you know, some of the worst things, it seems like. But after this family experiences a tragedy, they become entangled with their remote, reclusive, bigoted neighbor named Frank Fowler, who shows up to try to help them survive on this cotton farm. And things really get interesting and pretty bad for them.
Well, I can't wait to talk to you about it next year then.
I would love to come back and talk about that book. Everyone is pretty excited about it already.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, after the year that you've had, and now you're starting another year,
yeah,
do you have any favorite stories of your interviews or your book talks that you've done anywhere?
Oh, my goodness. Let me just say that I absolutely love doing all of the book events that I do, and they're all so unique and individual in their own way. I did my book launch at Quail Ridge in Raleigh, North Carolina, which is where I usually do it, and that's always exciting because you're launching the book. There's a ton of bookstores that I've been excited to go to. You know, I went to Page 158 Books. I've been to McIntyre's. I've been out to Polly's Island at Litchfield Books, hosted a movable feast there. 100 people showed up for that event,
wow,
so that was pretty exciting. I'm doing tons of book clubs. I actually have events scheduled all the way through August of this year, and it may be only one a month here and there, but yeah, there's something going on all the way through August. I honestly can't pick a favorite, although I'd have to say, no brown nosing here, but this is actually one of my favorite ones to do.
Well, because, we appreciate that.
Yeah, I love getting, you know, for somebody to do the interview and ask the questions and have such good insight and in-depth questions about the story and what it means.
Well, we appreciate you being here, and
thank
I will
you.
Look forward to seeing you again next year.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. We've reached the end of our time today. I've been talking with Donna Everhart about her book, The Road to Bittersweet. The book tells the story of Wallace Ann Stamper's coming of age in 1940s North Carolina. The book is published by Kensington Books. I'm Linda Lloyd, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library, all rights reserved.